welcome to another fun-filled episode of F1K Podcast. Ari Rosenbaum here along with Dan Venturi. Dan, how are you?
I'm doing well, sir. Another wonderful early fall Friday.
Yeah.
Very Oktoberfest-ish-y.
Yeah.
I was hanging out with the missus last night outside, and we've got one of them, you know, swings. And there was a definite bite to the air. Like, you can just tell that fall is knocking. It's going to get colder real fast.
Right.
So, anyway, what is today's topic of the day, sir?
Well, today's topic, we'll talk about the topic, just mention it. We're going to talk about the whole thing about the IPS, the Investment Policy Statement, debunk some of the thoughts about it, but also describe the need of it and obviously the problems with it. But before we talk about that, let's talk about, you know, obviously when we're recording this, when this drops, we will be in Cleveland. So we don't have to mention the Cleveland conference because by the time people hear this, it will have, you know, will have started. So anyway, after Cleveland, we're going to have an event in Foxborough. It's our very, very first football-themed that 401k conference. Up until now, we've only done baseball. We're doing football in Foxborough, home of the New England Patriots, Gillette Stadium, Friday, October 11th. Pretty soon, my buddy Larry's going to get us a guest. I actually texted Larry today. I'm like, we need a guest. We need a guest because it's only a few short weeks away. And, you know, some of us are going to try to get to that Patriots-Giants games the night before. So go to that 401ksite.com for more further information. And then, of course, in November, we're going to stay home a little bit, I guess, in New Jersey. Friday, November the 8th, MetLife Stadium, East Rutherford, New Jersey, for the New York Giants home. I mean, it's also the home of the Jets, but we really don't talk about them that much, and for good reason. I mean, already their quarterback has mononucleosis. I mean,
how ridiculous is that?
I mean, I know of teenagers who've had mononucleosis or college students. I can't remember last time I heard an adult get it, but it happens.
Only the Jets.
Exactly. And, you know, their backup is Trevor Seaman, so it's like, you know, whatever. I don't know.
A little bit more wordplay.
Exactly. And then we're going to be in Dallas, Arlington, Texas, AT&T Stadium, Friday, December 13th. It's going to be fun. That's our last event for 2019. 2020, Walt Disney World, that 401k National Conference. Was it March 9th? I think it's March 9th and 10th. It's going to be at Walt Disney World Swan, a fun national conference, some unique networking opportunities, a lot of good content. We'll get some appearances from some celebrities and all that kind of stuff. Go to that 401ksite.com for further information. Our friends at Lincoln are going to join us as one of the sponsors, FPS Trust, Alaris, and we're working on some others. Of course, Kravitz will be there. They've always been so supportive. So it's going to be a fun event. I already booked the hotel. I just didn't want to get locked out. And right now we have some really generous early bird specials for attendees and multiple attendees from the same firm. Those deals are going to probably end by the end of the year, so sign up. It's very, very inexpensive to be a part of it. We'll give you a break on the fees to attend because, you know, you got to fend for yourself when it comes to getting that hotel room. And, of course, buying those heavily discounted Disney tickets, which you can do from the link on our website. So hope for you guys to join us in Disney as well as the other events as well. And, of course... Again, the topic for today, we're going to talk about the investment policy statement, right? Because there's so many things about the investment policy statement that, you know, a lot of misconceptions about it, what it's supposed to do, what it's really not supposed to do. And, you know, sometimes I think it gets overblown, kind of like flossing, you know, flossing teeth, you know, they always, your dentist talks to you about flossing and how it's a great way of taking care of your teeth. And, you know, I can't remember the last time I flossed. You know, my teeth, I got a really small mouth, so I really have no spacing between my teeth, so I don't floss. But my teeth are pretty good. I take care of my, you know, you got to, you know, brush your teeth, take the Listerine kind of stuff. You take care of your teeth. You really don't need to floss. And I think that flossing is very, very overblown as this great tool and technique. And sometimes I feel that way about the investment policy statement.
So let me get this straight. The investing policy statement is very similar to flossing.
I think it's more important than flossing. I don't think it's as useless as flossing, but I think it's overblown as, you know.
Okay. So on the hierarchy of necessities, isn't there like a – who was the guy that came up with that hierarchy of necessities? Food, shelter, all that fun stuff. Air. So we'd put IPS on the hierarchy of – important 401k things somewhere above flossing and
below, well, I don't know what I don't know it. what flossing has to do with 401k plans, but I think that in terms of things in life, I think it's overblown like flossing. I just don't think it's as useless as flossing. It serves its purpose, but I think sometimes, and we'll talk about it, I think it's overblown as to its necessity and effectiveness. And, you know, it's a piece of paper and, you know, it's not like the Bible.
Okay.
You know, I think the Bible is more important. I think the fountainhead is more important. And the new rules of PR, was it the new rules of PR by Scott Meerman Scott? Those are the most important books ever written.
But, Ayn Rand makes the list, huh?
Yeah, and it was a really good book. Really, you know, really changed my life, as they say. Really important book. And of course, the books I wrote, which are still available on Amazon Kindle.
There you go.
You know, I got to sell more than 5 copies of a book. You know, got to make it 6. But anyway,
you need at least 10 to get on the bestseller list.
What he says, I'll get a review on the second book. Anyway, what is an IPS? An IPS is what it says it is. It's an investment policy statement. It's a document that really sets forth the objectives, restrictions, funding requirements, and general investment structure for the management of a plan's assets, and will provide the basis of evaluating those plan assets. And, you know, an IPS is really all about communication. It sets the guidelines and procedures to those assisting the investment process, such as the retirement plan advisors and the fiduciaries of the plan. And I think the funniest thing about the IPS is while everybody talks about it, there's nothing there that says it's actually legally required. You know? Much like flossing. Flossing isn't legally required.
It's not required, you know, to have good teeth either. But yeah, no, I agree with you. When I was on the other side of the aisle, so to speak, and sort of in committee meetings and adhering to IPSs, it's like part of that process that you create to show you're doing something, right? To sort of justify things. I think it's a good tool to engage a client. Right, to get them in the process to make sure that they're invested. It's certainly a good tool to demonstrate worth and you know, justify the expense. But to your point, there's nothing in ERISA, there's no guidance from the IRS or from the DOL that mandates that you adopt an investment policy statement.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that we talk about the IPS, and here's a fun fact, about 87% of ERISA plans have one. So still to this day, there are 13% of plans that don't. Again, it's not legally required. The reason, you know, number one, I think you need one is because it's really what it is. It's a blueprint. It's really about showing a process, that there is a process in place. There's a process in place in selecting and replacing funds. So when I was going through, I just recently finished a DOL audit on this restaurant group plan that literally took 18 months, and it was dealing with late deferrals. That was the big issue. That was the only issue, really. But when I went and had the interview with the DOL agent to begin the process 18 months ago, she asked, does the client have an investment policy statement? What's the process in place? And at the time, they just hired this new advisor, and they finally were going to implement one. So they didn't even have one at that time. I forget who they were. I think they were using some type of brokerage firm. So, listen, when the DOL asks you for one, while it may not be legally required, I think it's a really good fashion to have one, just because they ask for one. So it's really, it's really important. And again, like I said, it's an IPS is kind of evidence that you have a prudent process. Just like, when they suggest that sugary cereals like Count Chocula are somehow part of a nutritious breakfast, an IPS is an ingredient of a fiduciary process that's prudent. And obviously, if you're scoring at home, a prudent process is establishing an IPS, diversifying plan assets, making investment decisions with the skill and care of a prudent expert, and avoiding any type of prohibited transaction. And the DOL years ago in this interpretive bulletin said, the maintenance by an employee benefit plan of a statement investment policy designed to further the purposes of this plan and its funding policies is consistent with the fiduciary obligations set forth in ERISA. So, it's not legally required, but, it's evidence. And it's important that, you have one in place. But when you have one in place, it's actually really important to actually follow it. It's like a diet. How many times you go on a diet and you don't follow the diet? Well, what the hell good use is that diet? I lost 40 pounds when I was in high school. I kept the weight off for about 20 years. So for the last 7 or 8 years, I kind of wanted to lose weight. And I just, you start a diet, you follow it for a couple weeks, and then you hit a brick wall. You say to yourself, what's the point of it if I'm not going to follow it? And that's the same thing with IPS. What's the point of it if you're not going to follow it? And I will say that you're better off not having an IPS than having an IPS that you're not going to follow. Because an IPS is evidence of a process. And if you didn't follow the process, you know what they said about the Philly 76ers? Trust the process. When it comes to 401k plans, you got to follow the process. You got to follow the blueprint. That's what an IPS, it's a blueprint. When you're building a building and you don't follow the blueprint, what happens? Things fall apart. And that's the same thing about having an IPS and not following it. Things will fall apart. It is evidence that you are breaching a fiduciary duty because you had a policy and process in place. You didn't follow it. You'll get in trouble somewhere, somehow. Usually it's going to be the DOL rather than a class action lawsuit unless you're a big-time plan sponsor. And, you really got to follow it to the T. It's really just a really important part of a fiduciary process is having it in place and following it up. It's like buying that exercise bike. I mean, if you look in my house, how many exercise equipments I have and I don't use it. I have this exercise bike, bought it a few years ago on Amazon. I can't remember last time I used it. The battery's gone out from the electrical part of it. All it does is collect dust. And you can't afford, as a plan sponsor, to let the IPS collect dust. You got to follow the process, especially when you're dealing with participant-directed plans. You're not liable for the gains and losses that a participant incurs as long as you follow a prudent fiduciary process. And then another caveat of the IPS is, I believe, less is more. Again, it's like religion. Less is more sometimes. Don't make it like a religious document that you have to follow. When it comes to politics and and legal thought, you know, maybe I'm a strict constructionist like Antonin Scalia. When it comes to drafting an IPS, I'm more of a Justice Brennan, slippery slope, elastic, living, breathing documents that gives a lot of leeway to the advisor and the plan sponsor in changing investments. If you put something and you say, you know, if you put something in writing in red, you will do this. If the fund is in red after two quarters, we will replace it. And you don't, you breach your fiduciary duty. Most of the way times in IPS you draft it. If we have red based on the FI360 report for two quarters in a row, we will consider replacing it. So it's more elastic. It gives you an out, because if you put yourself in a corner, if you let the IPS put yourself in a corner, when you're in a corner, it's hard to get a way out if you don't follow exactly as the blueprint of the IPS.
Yeah, we used to, again, when I was doing this, we'd built in enough leash, right, enough latitude there that the plan sponsor doesn't hang themselves. You know, you don't want this document to be super restrictive. As you pointed, in that case, having one that is too difficult to follow, or having one and not doing anything at all those things get you in more trouble than if you just didn't have one. All right, so going down that path, and I imagine, you know, the vast majority of our listeners have one from the plan sponsor side. The advisors would probably champion using one on their side of things. It's important to make sure that it's followed. If the committee's supposed to meet every quarter, have the committee meet every quarter. I mean, one of our clients right now, we're working with an advisor to chase down the client. There's no one on in the bridge, so to speak, to pilot the plan. They're going through a transition, and we're basically trying to wrangle enough people to sit down for a few minutes, document the process. We're basically trying to save them about 20 basis points in investment costs, and we can't do it until we find enough people to or get the investment committee, what's left of the investment committee, together. So the long-winded answer and sort of supporting commentary to your point, Ari, is that if you have it, make sure it's written with enough width and leash to not get you or your plan sponsor client into trouble. And then make sure you follow it. Make sure you do what it says. Make sure if it says, you know, if the beta of a fund gets past this number, it's removed, then do it.
Yeah, follow. I mean, yeah, you're exactly right. And, you know, many years ago, I worked at this law firm, not the Meyer Suozzi that I always goof about, but some other firm. And I was working for this arista attorney. It was really, really brilliant. Her name is Janie. And I remember there was a change in the law. I wanted to use a model amendment drafted by, like, Relias. You know, would have charged a, you know, plan a few hundred dollars. It was a fill-in-the-blank type amendment. But she wanted to draft something that wasn't off the shelf. She wanted a individually designed amendment, and it was unnecessary. You know, it's great you could charge a client thousands and thousands of in dollars and fees when you could do something, in my opinion, for a whole lot less. And, you know, she always believed that, you know, more is more. And I believe that less is more. And when you see, you know, an IPS to me is like the story of Goldilocks. You need just an IPS that just fits right. You know, naming, like, I mean, I see a lot of mistakes. You know, I think something as dumb as naming the members by name of the fiduciary committee involved is a stupid thing to do. Because what happens when that person leaves? Then you got to redraft the IPS? Or you run the risk that you have an IPS that doesn't fit what is actually going on in the management of the plan. You want the IPS put in place with the advisor that's at hand, and then you never really have to augment and change it as long as you have that advisor in place. And, you know, you make, you know, having an IPS that you got to keep on amending every time somebody leaves, the fiduciary committee, to me, is making busy work that you really don't need and you really don't have to bother with. And, of course, I think it's most important that when it comes time to drafting it, it's the financial advisor that drafts it, because it's the financial advisor that is the one who's helping you select those investments, based on the criteria. So I don't think it makes sense for an ERISA attorney who has no background in picking funds to draft the IPS. There's so many damn samples for free on the web that, you know, your advisor could use and augment it and contour it to, you know, what, you know, they do in practice. You know, they're the ones who are going to help you manage it, so they're the ones that should be drafting it. You know?
Sure.
Just like just like I don't want an advisor to draft plan amendments.
Yeah, no, I don't think anyone wants an advisor to draft plan amendments. I don't think they want to draft plan amendments. But to the IPS point, most of the, you know, the software suites that folks use to evaluate performance, FI360s of the world, the RPEGs, all that stuff comes with model IPSs as well.
Right. You know,
so there's definitely no need to go out and reinvent anything.
Right. Everybody's very, very generous with giving out free IPSs because, you know, that's what it's all about. You know, because it's not, you know, you give it away for free because it's not worth that much. It's important to have, but, you know, they're elastic. It gives you a lot of outs for the advisor to follow or, you know, to really manage a plan. And I just think that it's overblown as to the sophistication and specificity that it really needs. So, you know, you have one in place, fits the needs of the advisor, and as long as the advisor works within the space allotted by the IPS and actually makes decisions that are allotted by the IPS, you should be fine. But, you know, like Count Chocula, it's only one part of a very nutritious breakfast. So an IPS is just one part of a very big fiduciary puzzle. It's one piece. It's not the dominant piece. Because if you have an IPS and you don't give the participants education and you didn't, and you didn't change funds for 10 years, hello, Pat, what's the point? You know, it's only one part of a very, very big puzzle, one small piece. Because I will say that giving education to participants is more important than IPS. It's just my two cents. So, when it comes to the fiduciary component of the plan, you know, the IPS isn't like Willy Wonka's golden ticket or some sort of get-out-of-jail-free card. You know, if the participants direct the investment, an IPS is only, you know, one thing that will help minimize liability. So, like I said, education is a bigger part of the puzzle in minimizing liability. Changing investments based on the IPS, that's more important than actually the IPS, but that's a whole other story.
Well, and I think we've spoken about it two or three times in previous episodes. The education requirement of 404C. Right? I mean, that's pretty much widely overlooked / ignored, right? I don't think any plan really complies all too well with that. So, to your point, plan sponsors, advisors should spend more time working on that education piece and making sure it's delivered frequently enough. You know, we had spoken about this. We're of the opinion that, you know, at least semi-annually something should be done,
right?
To fully comply with the written part of 404C, right? It's funny how like that part is written and no one pays attention to it, but the timeliness part, you know, the timeliness requirements that are written are widely ignored and everyone pays attention to what is sort of spoken rather than what's written,
right?
Just a weird little thing there. But I just to sort of reiterate what you said again, bud, I mean, I think it's a combination of things. There's no one holistic, all-in, you know, panaceic approach here. It's a couple of different pieces that work in conjunction with one another to have you comply with your fiduciary requirements or insulate you from, you know, fiduciary liabilities.
Exactly. You know, it's just one piece of the puzzle, and it's just funny that I feel sometimes a lot of the providers really put, you know, go all in on, you know, focusing on the IPS when there's so much more at stake and so much more that has to be managed in order to really minimize the liability of a plan sponsor.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, it's a lot of things, but then it's not everything. And I think that there's just too much focus on it. You know, to me, you know, many years ago, I took golf lessons, and I think, you know, eventually now the kids are older, I might actually go out and play again. But I had a very good golf instructor. I don't know if he's retired or not. But anyway, he pointed out, we're talking about, you know, all the golf tool, you know, golf clubs out there, and, you know, you could go broke buying golf equipment. I like Callaway's, always did. But, you know, he really, you know, he's Kenny Golf, as I call him. Kenny said that, you know, all a golf club really is a tool. It's how you use it. It's not, you know, it doesn't drive the ball. You drive the ball. It's just a tool that you use. If you slice, you know, no matter what club you're going to use, it's going to slice. If you don't hit it square, you know, the golf club is going to fix that. Sure, it may add some distance based on, you know, whether based on physics and, you know, sometimes the equipment, maybe, you know, using some of those clubs, especially the driver, may add a couple yards, but it doesn't help you, you know, cure that slice or, you know, make you hit, you know, that much straighter. So It's a tool. And that's the same thing with an IPS. It's just a tool. It's not going to keep the plan sponsor out of ERISA jail, as I would call it, or out of trouble. It's just a tool. It's how you use it. If the advisor on a plan isn't using it correctly by, you know, drafting something that's so tight or, you know, not following it, any aspect of it, it's of no use. Just like, you know, just like the golf club by itself. And I think that that's what people have to realize, that, you know, it's a tool. Like anything else, and it's just a matter of how you use it, and it's not the be-all, end-all when it comes to managing a retirement plan.
Agreed.
So I think we hit the nail on that one, you know? I brought up golf.
We always hit the nail on it. And the one thing I've been meaning to circle back on is you've mentioned Count Chocula now twice. And we would absolutely be remiss if we don't mention the other two parts of the festive Halloween serial trilogy there, Frankenberry and his cousin Booberry.
Yeah, who should
be lining the shelves of your supermarket.
What about Fruit Brute and Yummy Mummy?
Yummy Mummy?
Yes.
I don't remember Yummy Mummy.
A few years ago, first of all, Fruit Brute was part of the Monster Cereals, and there was one time a few years ago they actually brought it back for a limited time, and I actually bought it. I don't like sugary cereals. I think it's just awful, you know. And I think there was a Yummy Mummy.
Mummy.
Yeah, there was. So it was like the four of them, five
what
of them.
What flavor was Yummy Mummy?
Here, fruity Yummy Mummy. Fruit-flavored frosted cereal with vanilla-flavored marshmallows.
And this was part of the, what is it, General Mills that does?
Yeah. So Fruit Brute was part of it. Fruit Brute, how do you know Fruit Brute? I only learned of Fruit Brute because that was a cereal that the Eric Stoltz character had in Pulp Fiction. He was eating Fruit Brute.
Fruit Brute.
And
I must have missed that.
Yeah, Fruit Brute.
That was my early 20s. I must have been.
Fruit Brute is a werewolf. And he was in the 70s, they got rid of him. And a limited time, about 5 or 6 years ago, my wife and I wanted to try it or whatever. And was got, you know, I don't like sugar cereals. I mean, I'm not a big cereal fan to begin with, but if I would eat cereal, it would be like a Cheerios or a, you know, Crispix.
Something a little bit more heart healthy.
Yeah, Rice Krispies, Chex, that kind of stuff. That's probably why I have all my teeth. I never had the sugary cereals. Could eat that stuff. But yeah, Fruit Brute and Yummy Mummy are part of that. You can look it up on Wikipedia.
So there you go. Think of everything that folks got on today's podcast. Right, we've learned all about the fraudulent ways of flossing, right?
I wouldn't say it's fraudulent. I think it's a waste of time.
Let's call it the ineffective.
To me, take
ways of flossing.
To me, you take a swig of like Listerine Advanced, and that'll do the trick. Twice a day,
that'll do the trick. Yeah. All right. So a complete departure on conventional dental hygienic practices.
Right.
We've delved into the different iterations of Halloween monster cereal. And somehow brought the two together.
We eventually get there, and you know, this is what happens. And we mentioned Goldilocks, so.
And this is what happens on the that 401k podcast.
Remember when Dennis Miller was on Monday Night Football, and
I remember.
He used to have all these like kind of, you know, cultural allusions and sayings. And I remember the following day, ESPN.com would have like a guide to what the hell was Dennis Miller talking about. And sometimes I feel like we need a guide to, you know, talk
we
about.
Do.
You know,
we should tweet something out. We should have like an after show tweet or something.
Yeah, I think I might have to do it on Wikipedia, like an annotated. You know, here's the link to Fruit Brute. You know, because Fruit Brute, we don't get. I mean, he got
there the you love. Go. I'm telling you,
he got the love in Pulp Fiction, but that was about it.
Kind of like a Cliff Notes, a podcast Cliff Notes.
Yeah, and Booberry only comes out during Halloween season.
Yeah. Well, and so does Frankenberry. I don't think Frankenberry.
Frankenberry, you see, but not fruit, not the blueberry. Blueberry is really special.
Frankenberry's out year round.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So now I guess we got to go get some blueberry. Got to go to the supermarket and pick up some blueberry.
I wouldn't eat that. I just don't. It's funny, like cereals. What I funny thing I always mention about cereals is, like, you probably do a comedy act on it, just like in the sense that when I was a kid, there was one Cheerios and life was okay, and then there was Honey Nut Cheerios, and now if you go to the supermarket, you know, you got chocolate Cheerios,
it's a whole section of Cheerios,
you got whole grain Cheerios, you've got Dulce de Leche. I think they got rid of that. They have peanut butter. They have banana. I mean, like, how many fruity Cheerios? Like, how many? I mean, fruity Cheerios really is what you call it? Isn't is Fruit Loops? Yeah, that's really what it is. But that's a different company. But I mean, life was okay when we had one Cheerios, but now we need 12 Cheerios. The same thing with like Crest. I mean, how many different varieties of Crest toothpaste do you really need, or Colgate? It's the balkanization. It's the balkanization of the American buying public. So companies say, okay, well, you know what? You don't like Cheerios? Well, here's 50 different varieties, and maybe you'll like one of them.
Sure. As long as it's a Cheerios brand, what do I care?
I think there's like maple Cheerios, you know? It's just amazing what's coming out now.
It's available only in Canada. I don't know. I just made that.
No, I think they recently came out with that one.
It's for all of us.
Yeah, there was an Ancient Grains Cheerio. I don't know what the hell they were using, like quinoa. I don't know. It's like,
an heirloom grains here.
Like ancient. That, like, who needs that?
I don't. It's. They're not marketing that stuff to us. I will tell you that.
Listen, in the morning I have my avocado, and that's it. I don't have, you know, fruity avocado. I don't have, you know, maple.
You have chocolate avocado?
No chocolate avocado. Just have that. And I'm done with it. So, you know, that's which brings me into we got to get off this thing pretty soon because we got other things to tend to. But one last thing, whenever you were a kid talking about cereals and all that, I think the biggest lie you were ever told, at least the biggest lie I ever was told in my life, was that breakfast was the most important meal of the day.
You don't agree?
I hate breakfast, and. The reason I hate breakfast is because I think that when you come to dieting and trying to maintain a decent weight, the worst thing is breakfast. You know, I have this thing where it's just like if I only have like 300 calories from, you know, the morning till, you know, late afternoon, I'm fine. And you know, when you load up with the bagel or you load up with, you know, this hearty, hearty breakfast, you know, you can't really, you know, you end up, you'd have to eat like, you know, vegetables for dinner or something, like celery. So that's again, another segue about my ideas of nutrition. So
we could pick that up on next week's episode.
Exactly. We're probably going to be recording from Cleveland.
With a special guest.
Hopefully. I have my recorder. I just have to learn how to use it. And I found out the hard way that the memory disk that I had was too big for it. And I'm getting one today. So hopefully this weekend I'll play around with it and see how to use it and all that kind of stuff.
That'd be a worthwhile endeavor, my friend.
Exactly. So until next week, it's Dan and Ari saying so long.
Have a great weekend.